We're going to turn this morning. We're going to start reading in Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians 5. We have a number of people that are here this morning that were not here the last two or three weeks. And so I'm going to give a little bit of a review this morning. There are essentially three things that we tend to filter this passage through. We've talked over the last few weeks how words in of themselves technically are neutral in that words are containers of beliefs, words are containers of feelings, words are containers of a spirit, if you will. In fact, the scripture tells us that the spirit is truth. And there are certain words that have changed meaning in the English language. That would be great. There's certain words that have changed meaning in the English language. My great example that I use is that in the King James, the Bible uses the word in the book of Hebrews. I'm going to spell it because my wife gave me my phone. In other words, she's saying, don't go too long this morning. So I'm going to spell the word B-A-S-T-A-R-D. I actually will not read that when I come across it in the King James, especially in a public setting where children are at, because that word has taken on essentially the basically the spirit of a curse word, if you will, in many respects. And words tend to change meanings. The word believe, whosoever believeth in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. That's a strong word in Daniel Webster's 1828 dictionary. In our society, it's not as strong. Do you find yourself, when you're encouraging someone to believe, re-explaining the word believe? I find myself re-explaining it. Not taking away from the scripture, obviously. But I find myself encouraging someone that the word believe means to place your confidence in Christ. I show them where the Bible uses the word believe interchangeably with faith and also trust. And in this scripture in Ephesians chapter 5, when you read this publicly, I can sense that people are misinterpreting it. And they're misinterpreting it because we're filtering it. We're filtering it through three basic things. I believe that we're filtering it, first of all, through potentially our rebellious hearts. Secondly, we're filtering it through our tendency towards extremism. And what I mean by that is if you encourage someone who's a brand new believer to forsake all and follow Christ, well, some people, and I know that I had this propensity when I was a brand new believer, some people are going to take that to an extreme measure, if you will. Forsake all and follow Christ. That means that I should have no pleasure, I should have no joy, I should live like a monk in a monastery and eat stale bread and water. So we tend to have this extreme approach. I know that through counseling, most of the time, I can give a very good principle, but it's being misinterpreted through people's extreme thinking. So if I say to somebody, well, use gentleness, they'll say, oh, you just want me to sit down, shut up, and not say a word. Well, that's not what I said. But you're filtering it through our propensity to be extremists. But the biggest thing that we're filtering Ephesians 5 through is human failure. And we've talked about this over the last few weeks. God does not have this amazingly wonderful book, and then there's these like eight verses in Ephesians 5 that we have to be a little apologetic about that talks about headship and submission. And because of my rethinking, God says, be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the what? Renewing of your minds. Because of my rethinking, when I see the word head in Ephesians 5, I'm seeing something very beautiful. When I see the word submit, I'm seeing something very beautiful. But what we're going to hear, and what I've shared with you the last few weeks, is that I go through an entire marriage conference, 4 to 5 sessions. I'm traveling up to North Carolina next week, in fact, to do a marriage emphasis Sunday. And I spend 4 to 5 sessions with couples encouraging the wives to submit without using the word submit. And what I mean by that is that, once again, if I just put these verses out there, there's so much filtration going on, so much filtering going on, such as if I quote the verse, obey those that have the rule over you. Some of you are going to filter that through religiously abusive people that have misused that verse to try to get you to vote for a building program. Or they've misused that verse to try to purport or try to spread their legalistic tendencies, if you will. And so some of us, what we tend to do is we tend to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Obey those that have the rule over you is a beautiful verse. It's beautiful. If I've ever been in a church and I have a pastor who's over me or that is shepherding me, and he encourages me with something scriptural, and he says, hey, you need to learn how to how to love your wife as Christ loved the church. If I submit to that principle, as long as it's biblical, guess what? I'm obeying those that have the rule over me. So in saying all that, let's go to Ephesians chapter 5. I have to give that a little bit of a background because we get to the word submit. If you haven't been here the last 3 or 4 weeks, you're going to be filtering that through your background, your propensity towards extremism, human failure, and that's never a good place for us. Once again, I have to really nail this down. God does not have this amazing book with all these wonderful promises and then 8 verses that Christians have to be apologetic about. God's ways always produce a win-win for His glory and those that are submitted to Him. Always. And that's why the longer I teach the Bible, I want to be even more biblical. I want to be more submitted to everything that God says, because anytime I've went away from the Word, listen, no one has ever sinned and never been sorry for it. No one has ever sinned and never been sorry for it. We say, well, I'm not sorry for that. Well, you will be at some day, at some point. You reap what you sow. And it may take a while for your harvest to come, but it's going to come. Be sure your sin will what? Find you out. Can't you just envision your 95-year-old grandma with an arthritic finger? Be sure your sin will find you out. But she's right. I've never went wrong by obeying the Word of God. So God doesn't have these like 8 verses that we have to be apologetic about. I've got whole articles on why the biblical model is the best model. And if we don't think it's the best model, it's because, once again, we're misinterpreting it. We've misapplied it. We've saw people that look like they were applying it, but it produced bondage rather than freedom. Headship produces freedom in our household. In fact, whenever we get into bondage in our household, it's because I'm typically not being the head that I should be. A great indicator of what's going on in our scenario between God and me is indicated by what's going on between my wife and myself. That may not be the case in all contexts. I know some very godly men that I've counseled hours upon end, and they're just trying to deal with the fact that they have a contentious and a brawling wife that no matter what they do, they can't make her happy. That happens, but that's probably in 5% of the cases, and honestly, probably less than that. 95% of the issues in marriage start with the husband not loving his wife as Christ loved the church. Then husbands say, well, I have been loving her. Wait a second. Have you been loving her with wisdom? Read my article at hittinghomeministry.com called The 6 Paradoxes of Marriage for Men. Sometimes you can think you're doing the right thing, but you'll find out that you actually were projecting yourself on her and not really loving her wisely, and we're not going to get into all that today. But with all that out of the way, now why did we say that we have to give all these disclaimers? Why is it that in the 1700s, when Matthew Henry deals with Ephesians 5, he can just say it and people get it? Why is it? Does anybody know why? In the last days, God said there would be a society that's what? Without what? Natural affection. Did you know that when I'm counseling, especially people from very liberal areas, whether it be California, especially places with high densities of population, and by the way, Thomas Jefferson believed that big cities would be the downfall of our country. Isaiah 5 says, woe unto them that lay house against house. And the point being is that high population areas become cesspools for bad thinking. And it just feeds off of itself. And it's just almost as if those high population areas can't stop themselves. And I've said this before, I'll say it again. When you are not in connection of where your food comes from, you'll start to get distorted as a human being. Now, I know that sounds kind of crazy for most people to hear, but you know that we just about 5 years ago, the world passed a line that it had never passed before. You know what that line was? About 5 years ago, we passed a stage where more people lived in the city than lived in an agricultural setting or a country setting or a rural setting. Did you know that? Just a few years ago. Isn't that interesting? And the point being is that I find that people that are in connection of where their food came from, of nature itself, for a long time I wouldn't go buy something at Mother Earth. I was protesting against it, right? And so, but what was interesting is that when we're a connection of where our food comes from and how God has to supply that, and you get your hands into dirt, there's a common sense that stays within you, and you're able to keep your feet on the ground. I'm not saying everybody lives in a rural area is wise and is a wonderful sage, but listen to this. Ephesians 5, let's notice this here. Ephesians 5. So with all that in mind, let's go back to Ephesians 5. The first two words are wives submit. The same Greek word that's used for submit here is the same Greek word that's actually used a few verses before when it says submitting yourselves one another in the fear of God. And you'll find here it says, let's back up to verse 18 if you don't mind. And be not drunk with wine when it is excess, but be filled with the Spirit, be under the control of the Spirit. It says speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your hearts to the Lord. When you think of the word fill with the Spirit, think of a sail that's filled with wind. It's under the control of that wind. And one of the things that you can use as a spiritual check mark or a spiritual barometer is, do you have a spirit of worship? Whenever my heart is away from the Lord, my heart is overcharged with the things of this life, what's one of the first things that go? A spirit of prayer, a spirit of praise. A spirit of prayer and a spirit of praise. Used to be hymns that would say, how long has it been, how's that verse go, Mel, since you talk with the Lord. There used to be an old hymn, ere you left this room this morning, did you think to pray? And if you'll notice here, it says, giving thanks always for all things unto God and the Father in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. He says we're to submit ourselves one to another in the fear of God. And then he says, wives, submit yourselves unto your husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife. And the question we've been asking, when you see the word submit and the word head there, what are you thinking? Are you thinking of some Middle Eastern setting where the husband is ruling over the wife, he won't let her drive? There are some people that would take it to that extreme. That's not, I believe, especially in our setting, a biblical interpretation of that. For the husband is the head of the wife. I believe that headship is a place of 99% service, 1% decision making. And if you want to walk tall as a man, listen to the last 3 or 4 weeks, if you want to walk tall as a man, you better be willing to get low and serve your wife. Not because she's the head, but because Christ came not to be ministered unto, but to minister. And Christ, you find him washing the dirt out of the disciples' feet. You find him serving the church. And that paved a way for him to gain eternal respect from the church in the book of the Revelation. One of the things that I've been thinking about lately is that as I counsel men to do this, the biggest barrier I'm coming up against, and if you don't know what I do, we have a ministry called Hitting Home, and we counsel people all week long, couples from all over the country. So I'm not just speaking from a pastor's perspective who's read a couple books on this. I think I've calculated over the last 12 years, I've done over 10,000 counseling sessions with husbands and wives in need. But as I encourage men to serve their wives, they feel like they're putting themselves in a place where the wife can be dominant over them. Now, understand, a lot of things are twisted, and a wife may take that, and she may twist that around, and she may feel like she's in control if that happens. But what's interesting is that we have moved into a matriarchal society. Do you know what that means, children, matriarchal? It means rather than being a society where masculine energy and masculine thinking, male thinking, tends to run things and affect a lot of things, we're more feminine, we're more maternal, more woman-like in nature. Let me explain how that is. And let me explain how you can see that in our society. So Little League Baseball, okay? Well, let's back up a little bit. In basketball, we found that it was amazing how hard it was to get the boys to dive on the ground and be aggressive, but the girls would naturally do it. The girls would fight and crawl and scrape and use their fingernails. Yes, Emma Flood did that. And and the boys, we can't even get them to dive on the floor. We can't get them to be tough. It's flipped around, isn't it? Little League Baseball. You see a batter up there, and he's barely holding the bat, and he's 6 or 7 years of age. And some of you, you're going to hear this, and you're going to have to kind of work through this. Moms, you're going to have to work through this. But they'll get hit by the ball. Now, when you're coaching, there's a difference between pain and an injury. Will, you're a tough guy. Would you not agree? There's a difference between pain and injury. At some point, we started to substitute pain for an injury. And there is something that can happen on an athletic field where you know that player is okay. Every once in a while, somebody can tear an ACL, and most people tear ACLs when no one's around them. No one's hit them, and so you're like, just get up, and they're like still on the ground. You're like, okay, this is a really bad one. But most of the time, you'll see a 6 or 7 year old get hit with a ball, and you know it's okay, and here's what you see on the Little League field. They'll drop the bat, drop to the ground, and mama drops everything and comes out to make sure they're okay. Now, that's a mom's role, right? That's her prerogative. That's her right. That's fine. But as a daddy, what I tell my mom, my wife, is, it's okay. Let them go. They're going to be all right. But what we've done is it takes, to succeed in life, it takes a masculine fighting spirit. I don't care what people say about business. It takes toughness to run a business, right? It takes toughness to do something in life. You've got to be better than the other guy. You know what's interesting is I was teaching a room full of teenage boys up at Prime Retail a few years ago, and I said business is about war. And the questions I got from the young men was, well, then we're supposed to be dishonest in business? And I said, why did you equate war with dishonesty? Do you see the subtle effect that our society has had, that if you're fighting, you're bad? We've defined a good boy by him sitting like a good girl. You ever thought about it? We've defined a good boy by him sitting like a good girl. Well, he's quiet and he doesn't make any noise. And listen, I've raised 4 boys and I've raised 4 girls, and the girls come in, they sit in a circle and they what's that word? What do they call it? They play patty cake and things like that, and all the energy's in and everything's good, and I thought I was a good parent until I had 3 boys in a row. But anyway, I thought I was a great parent, but what's interesting is we define a good boy by him being a good girl. When I told those young men that business is war to me, what makes money valuable is few people have the skills to make a lot of it, and what makes money valuable is few people have most of it. And because of that, you have to be doing what the other guy's not doing. It's war. That doesn't mean you're pushing someone down. I do more to help other businesses. I give business away all the time. All the time. And the point being is that when I think about war, though, well, let's go back to the Little League field. What's happening is that to be successful as a country, you have to be tough. You got to be able to take hits. You know, they said about Muhammad Ali, it wasn't just his quickness. It was his ability to take a punch that actually allowed him to be the heavyweight champion of the world. Did you know that? Isn't that interesting? But in war, you have to be able to take hits. You have to succeed as a society. We have to be able to stay in the game, and that's not going to be a mother-like spirit. It's not going to be the spirit of someone running to you and saying, are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay? Now, that's necessary in life. We need the balance. But I'm telling you, I'm seeing it more times than not. Little kid gets hit with the ball. He's okay. I can tell you 99 times out of 100, he's okay. And mama growing crazy, running out to the field, and everyone thinking that's absolutely normal. And my wife knows, and she's okay because she wants her boys to be young men. But it's not that I got to hold her back. But the point being is that I've got to watch myself as a dad because we want them to be tough. Marriage is designed to be like dad's old thermos, as we said last week. Anybody remember dad's old thermos? It was always green for some reason, and it was always just it had marks on the side of it. It was always dented, but it was tough on the exterior. But on the interior, what really kept the beverage cold or hot was this very thin layer of metal. And the point being is that the woman is to be that delicate, thin layer that I believe she's infinitely powerful when she is using her femininity to complement the man's masculinity. Do you know what made Sarah Palin extremely powerful when she was on the political scene? Is she retained her femininity, and she wasn't trying to be like a man, although she was still tough. Isn't that interesting? But in saying all that, going back to the passage here, the scripture says here, for the husband is the head of the wife. I see service when I see that. I'm not going to go back and re-preach this. I'm just being a little sensitive of the fact that we have people here that weren't here the last few weeks. The husband loved. Then he says, therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ. What we said the last few weeks is that's beautiful. Like this phrase isn't beautiful, then the other phrase is not beautiful. I mean, it's not like that, right? Church being subject unto Christ. He told me, come unto me, all ye that labor and heavy laden, I will give you rest. That's beautiful. So if it says, as the church is subject unto Christ, that's beautiful. The wives submit to themselves to their husbands. That's also beautiful. And if you don't think it's beautiful, it's because you're filtering it through human failure, your propensity towards extremism, or you're filtering it potentially through bad teaching. Look what he says here. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives even as Christ loved the church. Now, there is a group out there in religious circles that are trying to redefine the word submit here. It doesn't work to do it. But it's amazing how they don't try to redefine husbands love your wives as Christ loved the church, but they do try to redefine the word submit. Isn't that interesting? And what they'll say is, let's keep reading here if you don't mind. He says, so I want to get to the crux of this because I don't want to go long today. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. Then he says, so ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. We've talked about that the last few weeks. For no man yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. The fundamental criticism that ladies have in a marriage counseling room is not that he would be more popular, not that he would drive a better car. It's rarely that he makes more money, unless there's a work ethic issue. It's also because of his inability to be sacrificial towards her needs. God nails it here. And he says here, for we are members of his body. So we're actually a part of the body of Christ. So just as God doesn't forget his body, God is aware of the body. I found that the fundamental need for husbands is to be aware. And it's very easy. We, as Mark Gunger says it so well, we want to get into a nothing box. Especially after a long day of work, we want to get into a nothing box. And we want to zone out as men. And the greatest thing that I find, the greatest currency, if you will, that if I spend this, I'll have a good marriage, is being aware of the needs and acting upon them that are around the house. Now notice this here. For this cause shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Now it says they two shall be one flesh. You know, I hear people talk about what he gets to do, now what she gets to do. We've never looked at it that way. We're one flesh. Her bank account, his bank account, we've never done it that way. We're one flesh. Are there situations where the dysfunction is so high that maybe precautions have to be taken there? I've counseled some of those situations, but those are typically extreme situations, exceptions that do what we call prove the rule. And you'll notice here, it says that they're one flesh. My wife and I are joined at the hip. We text each other all the time. We know what we're thinking. It's not her life, my life, and then we just try to get along. We're one flesh. Just as we're members of his body. And God can't forget his body. He feels his body. We are to be aware of the needs of the wife and try to meet those needs as much as possible. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, and this is what I want to get to, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself it is, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. I find it amazing how even in secular people, because one of the things I found is that no matter how bad the ideology gets out there, I find that nature wins out. You've heard me teach on this before. You rarely ever hear of a commercial encouraging the women to buy for the men on Valentine's Day. Isn't that interesting? When you're at a stoplight and you're in your vehicle and you look towards the left, you are not going to find a 280-pound, big, burly, bearded truck driver guy on the back of that Harley and a little petite 90-pound blonde on the front of the Harley. You're not going to find it. The man is on the front of the Harley. Nature has a way of winning out. And we say that because I'm amazed that even in healthy situations with husbands and wives that are that are even secular, how you'll find that the man is using his masculinity to protect her as a woman and to love her as a woman. And she is, guess what? Because submission, I think you can wrap it up almost in one word. She's responding. And she's utilizing her femininity to complement his masculinity. And what we said last week is I'm amazed that when a young man pursues a young woman, it's amazing how she will naturally, if she likes being pursued by him, she will naturally submit to him. I want you to think about this. Here's what she'll do. I find that she'll naturally be soft towards him if she really likes him, if you will. If she really enjoys him pursuing her, she will be soft towards him. She'll laugh at his jokes. I'm amazed, by the way, young men, at, you know, my wife used to think I was really funny till about 3 years into marriage, and the jokes are no longer funny, but it's not just men that change, by the way. But anyway, she'll find and talk about the best side of him. She'll be willing, as a young man pursues a young woman, you'll find that she'll respond by overlooking his faults. When he's ever over the top and maybe a little aggressive, she'll say, oh, he's just crazy. You'll find that young girls, I find, or young women for that matter, they're naturally responsive. They're soft. They laugh at his jokes. They find and talk about what about the best in him. They're willing to overlook his faults. They'll allow him to be aggressive without criticism. And I think that's a large part of submission, by the way. Now, this is often a little harder to do, though, after marriage, when, first of all, you see the worst in when the worst in each other comes out. You know the beautiful part of marriage is you see the good, bad, and ugly of one another. You see the best and you see the absolute worst of that person. And you're still together and you still love one another. And that's the kind of love that you want as you go older. Do you want 18-year-old giddy love that's based upon feeling alone? No, when you're older, you don't look like you used to when you're 18 and you're potentially even changing each other's undergarments, honestly. You're going to want a solid, stable love. But the beauty of marriage is that you are one flesh. You see the best and you see the absolute worst of that other person. This is why we encourage young people not to be physically involved with one another, because the feelings that are derived from being physical, they will intoxicate you, and you will not, and you'll blur your vision from seeing the negative aspects about the relationship and the other person. And what's going to have to happen is after marriage, that emotional flood is going to subside, because the newness and the curiosity is going to be worn off. And then what happens is you're going to be sitting there staring right at the negative aspects of the relationship and one another that you should have seen 7 months, 8 months, a year before marriage. But you were intoxicated too much because you were being physical with one another. Listen, God's ways work, okay? Now, if you'll notice here, and I'm not going to try to go to too many disclaimers here, but I'm going to say this. A young woman, I'll notice she's naturally responsive. Here's where I'm coming from on this. I was preaching in I was doing a marriage conference in Wheeling, West Virginia a few years ago. And we had a question and answer time after the conference. And some guy said, you got to be more specific about how to love your wife, because I just don't get it. And I was not going to let him off on that. I said, well, you figured it out before you got married, right? You figured it out. Remember, we have the expression, we can't believe that people pay us as much to talk to them this way, right? But I said, you figured it out before marriage. So many men, they're willing to treat their wives like the Queen of Sheba before they meet them. I'm sorry, when they meet them. And then what happens is she slowly becomes dethroned from the royal palace, only to be replaced by jobs, careers, busyness. And here's a big one, the pressures of life. Young people, and I'm not speaking down at you, I'm really just speaking with you here. But I want you to know that I know that sometimes it seems like you're being warned at every level. It seems like, oh, it can't be that difficult. But I'm going to tell you, life will put you in a vice grip at some point and squeeze you harder than you've ever been squeezed before. And at that point, you better hold the hand of your wife and say, you know what? We're scared, but we're going to be scared together. We're depressed, but we're going to be depressed together. My wife and I have had times literally while I've woken up, I've had 5 children running to the breakfast table, and I haven't had a dime to my name, honestly, to take care of the next day's meals. And as a man, You know, it's funny, my children said something the other day. They said, my children said a lot of things the other day, but my children said something the other day. They said, Dad, we never knew when you lived in Pennsylvania, you were going through all these difficult times financially. It was actually Mark. He said, he's 24 and he's starting to realize that to support his family, it takes a lot of work. And he said something to me. He said, I realize nobody's going to do this for me. I'm like, welcome to manhood. And then the second thing is he said, we never realized, as we're just little kids and we're playing and we're living in this beautiful house in Pennsylvania. He said, we never realized the financial pressure you were under. Young men, that's called manhood. It doesn't mean you bottle everything up, but it means, guess what? You take the hits. You take them. And you know what you do the next day after you're knocked down? You get up in the morning, you put your pants on, and you get right back up and go at it. It's called manhood. And it's hard sometimes, but that's what men do. Think of the thermos. Take the hits on the outside. Let it all be dented up. And on the inside, you're protecting that little metal area that's very, very delicate, but it's what does the trick. My wife and her spirit, it makes the essence of our home work. And we're just as flawed as everyone else, but it makes the essence of our home work. But the point is that if I'm not taking the hits as a man, I'm going to force her to have to be something she's not. She's going to have to take the hits. She's going to have to carry something she wasn't created to carry. And at that point, you can use a screwdriver as a hammer, but guess what? It's only going to work so long. And at some point, she's going to crack and she's going to start compromising in what she does in life and compromising in what she gives her attention to. I don't want to put my wife in that situation. That's called headship, taking the hits. If you think headship is this is my way and that's how we're going to do it, you're so distorted. You need to hang around a lot of older men that are getting this right. You need to hang around them a long time and hang around them a lot. And after you've hung around them a long time and a lot, hang around them a lot longer. And just trust what they're saying. I was the least like a man when I was trying to demand respect as a young man. But when I was earning it, then it led to the point where I didn't have to demand it. Guess what? My wife started to give me that respect. Now, let's understand as we look at this that a young woman, God says once again in Proverbs 30, I believe it is, that there are three things that are wonderful in the world, and he talked about a fourth. And one of those is the way of a man with a maid. And when a man is, and I love to see a relationship that God is putting together. By the way, real quick. In the book of Timothy, God says that set a deacon aside and they should be approved. In other words, public sentiment in the church should put God's stamp of approval on that. Here's why I say this. When a young man and young woman get together, there's often a stamp of approval, and maybe there's some rare exception to this, but most of the time people are like, yeah, that's a good relationship. That's going to go somewhere. That's God putting that together. That's the way my wife and I work. And my point is this, is that you've heard me say it before, I'm going to say it again. If everybody that you've ever known and loved in your life is waving red flags, more than likely, 99.9% of the time, you're about to make the biggest mistake of your life. So think about that. She's soft. Laughs at his jokes. She finds and talks about the best in him, overlooks his faults. But it's a little harder to do when the worst in each other comes out. A little harder to do when the pressures of life come in and life gets crazy. That's why young people, I want to encourage you. I see some young people getting out of high school and the first thing they do is finance a car. Man, I know there's a lot of different views on this, but I want to encourage you, young men, buy your cars by cash and get on YouTube and learn to work on them. Here's why. If you meet someone and get married, God said that the young men were to take a year and cheer up their wife. God said they were to take a year. They weren't to go out to battle. They were to stay home and cheer their wife. And the Bible says the borrower is servant to the lender. And the car note is the line item in the budget that makes it very difficult for a lot of young couples to survive. You can usually eke out the rent or what you're doing for a place to live. You can usually eke out food. I mean, what does it take? Beans and rice the first year, right? It doesn't take much. But ramen noodles, but that car note, I see it totally enslave young couples. And you want to stay out of debt. You want to be in a place where you have time on the weekend, where you have time throughout the week where you don't have to work a second and third job as much as possible. The pressures of life get crazy. She's hurt. So she's going to have a harder time responding. Women have a gigantic hurt button. I can get into a squabble, hurt me, I'll get up the next day, I'm fine. Hurt my wife, 3 or 4 days into a bomb shelter. And if she constantly sees selfish behavior, she's going to have a harder time responding as she wants to respond. Now, how does a wife submit to her husband? We've given the disclaimers in our backwards society or backwards time. We need to do that. But I think that first of all, submission to a man means that the wife allows her husband to lead in his own way. I'm going to say it again. The wife allows her husband to lead in his own way. One of the best principles that helped us when we were first married is that different is not bad. Different is just different. Different is not bad. Different is just different. And I found that husbands almost always have a different way of accomplishing tasks than their wives. In fact, my wife started a handbag business a few years ago, and she would stress over every penny that she originally put into that. For myself, honestly, I have no problem throwing capital at something in order to expand it. I have no problem digging down in order for it to dig up. I'm not to be reckless with that, and I'm not to be hypocritical with that. But I will say this, that we have different approaches. She goes east, I go west, but we'll land at the same destination. But let me say that if you're married, I can guarantee you one thing. Opposites do attract. And he is going to have a different way of accomplishing things than you. By the way, you married a man. You didn't marry a woman trapped in a man's body. He's going to slam cabinet doors. He's going to potentially leave a mess. He's going to potentially leave his clothes on the floor. I'm not condoning all these things. He's going to smell. There's just a lot of things. But do you want a man or a woman in a man's body? You married a man. He's going to be masculine. He's going to overlook things, especially men in their 20s. When my wife and I set out to do a project, like I said, we have a different way of arriving at our destination. But she may head west, I go east. And when tackling something together, there are times when a purely democratic decision will actually lead to a standstill or a watered-down decision. Did you know there's no such thing? What's interesting to me is that when people throw off the idea of masculinity or the idea of headship, what's amazing to me is they never find a balance where it's 50-50. It always actually ends up with the feminine side of the equation actually becoming masculine. Isn't that interesting? There's no such thing as 50-50 decision making. And so what I mean by that is that the more dominant personality is going to win out, the more emotional personality, the more persistent. In other words, if you move away from the headship submission scenario, which I believe complements both the man and both the woman, it lifts both up. As we said, I've said it 1,000 times, but Adrian Rogers said, my wife does not want to be equal with me because then she'd have to come down from her pedestal. And let's understand this, that as you look at this here, there's no such thing as a purely democratic decision because it will lead to a standstill or a watered-down decision. Now, I believe that a wise man will consult the opinion of his wife, and in almost every situation in my life where I have not consulted the opinion of my wife, I've been in error and I've made a bad decision. In almost every situation where I've asked my wife about something, and she said, well, I think it's this, and we've disagreed, and I went ahead with it. In almost every situation, I've made a bad decision. The same spirit that speaks to her is the same spirit that can speak to me. Now, I understand I have maybe a propensity for risk. And one of the things that we say in our 6 paradoxes for marriage for men, if you're a young man, get on hittinghomeministry.com, read the 6 paradoxes of marriage for men. The very last paradox that we put on there is that love and safety are not the only two emotional needs of a woman. Matter of fact, you can't give a woman everything she wants. You also have to put some danger and some risk into the scenario. What makes a great movie scene? What makes a great romantic movie scene? Do little girls read about stories about a safe and totally neutral rescue? No, it's a dangerous, risky rescue. Let your man be dangerous. But the problem is we've had so much danger without discretion, we're throwing out the baby with the bathwater, and we've eliminated danger. So many times a man is dangerous, and I really believe that what we're experiencing politically right now is not just left versus right. It's not just the fact that somebody's wanting to drain the swamp and he's disrupting their embezzlement schemes. But I believe it's masculinity versus a matriarchal spirit going on in our society with Donald Trump. I believe he needs to tone it down at times. I don't believe, I love the demeanor of Mike Pence far better than the demeanor of Donald Trump. I believe Mike Pence is probably the most polished, balanced politician that you'll find on the scene today, and he's a very dedicated Christian. Pence 2024. But anyway, listen, I would never, ever, ever, ever use my position as a pastor to influence you politically. Pence 2024. But listen, let's understand that you can't just, you know, I have a whole article that a woman wants what she doesn't really want. She's going to cling to the castle walls while she's asking you for a rescue. And you have to be able to learn how to read that. And you may say, well, I just want a woman to say what she means then. Well, first of all, you're taking the mystery out of romance. Secondly, you're taking an element out of it that God has fundamentally always had. But also, let's understand that she's going to drop breadcrumbs of information about what she really wants and maybe not say what she... Because she doesn't want to be feel culpable to you. She's actually being respectful to you. And when you say, well, I want her just to say what she really wants, well... Listen, life is all about mystery. The mystery of the gospel. No story is good with the climax at the front. This whole thing called life is the best fairy tale story ever told. We need mystery. Looking at this here. Couples will find that this approach will fast forward them through the learning curve of relationships. What I mean by that is I say here that a wise man will consult the opinion of his wife as the same spirit that leads him is able to lead her. He will also be humble enough to admit that she has a better plan if she does. But if the two cannot agree on what I call a judgment call, then the man's opinion should win out. And that's going to happen at times. There's going to come a place where at times you're not going to be able to totally agree. And somebody has to pull the lever. Here's what I say here. This is really interesting. I see couples that will fight over for weeks and months, some even years that I've counseled, about where to move, financial decisions, what to purchase, etc. And at some point, somebody is going to have to pull the lever. There's no such thing as a true 50-50 split. It just doesn't occur in life. It doesn't exist. The wife can submit by refraining from controlling through manipulation. A wife can sometimes try to control a house by refraining from giving out too much information about events, plans, and wishes. And it can be, depending on the motive, especially a very deceptive practice, if you will. Be careful, wives, young wives, about playing chess with the information that you have about the home. What you're going to find is if you're always managing relationships, and therefore what you're doing is you're always playing chess with the information that you have, you're going to tire yourself out. Now, the difficulty in me saying this, though, because I can hear the voice come up before I even say it. The difficulty is most of the time when the wife is having to manage the household all the time and manage relationships, and she's tempted to withhold information, not give that information, tell some person this information, and she's going to tire herself out. The difficulty with this is usually there's a problem with headship, because usually what she's managing is the fact that people aren't getting along, and they're not getting along because the husband walks through the house all gruff and grumpy half the time, or he's not spending time as he should, or he's not sticking up with wisdom as he should. But be careful, because this chess game, it speaks to both the man and the woman, but this chess game that you can start to play, you'll tire yourself out. A woman, I think, can submit by refraining from emotional mutiny. Emotional mutiny. Young people, mutiny is like on a ship and people taking over a ship, and where the people that are working on the ship actually become the captain of the ship. And some women are deathly afraid of the man getting upper hand. And some women love a feeling of control. And you know what? I find that love and marriage and the essence of romance really dictates that the woman release control. And most women are just wanting a setting where they can release control, if you will, and let the man be a man. But through backroom conversations, emotional bashing sessions about the man and his leadership, through the structuring of information, a woman can lead an emotional mutiny of sorts that will rise to the children and other family members and their friends. And the man may not hear other people talking about him, but remember, gossip is not always heard, but it's always felt. And the man may never hear those conversations, but the woman is structuring information to kind of make sure that everybody has a darker view of him than that is really present. She can many times try to control through that. It doesn't happen in a lot of situations, but it does. A wife can submit to her husband by offering her opinion in a way that allows him to still feel like a man, if you will. I want to share something with you. I talk a lot and I teach a lot about what goes on with a woman when her hurt button is hit, when she doesn't feel emotionally safe. But I want to flip the tables around a little bit. There is something that happens in a man when a woman speaks with anger and disrespect. There's something that goes off that is not talked about a lot. But you, man, you just tell me if you've experienced this before. But at times when I would not love my wife as Christ loved the church and I wouldn't cover her, then I would push arguments to the point where finally she would just crack and lose it. When she would speak angrily, disrespectfully towards me, first of all, women have an ability to say the worst things that could just make a man, just take a man down the side. But also there's something that happens inside of a man when a woman is speaking angrily and disrespectfully. There's something that causes you'd rather be hit with a sledgehammer. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? There's something that just like, it's like taking a stick of dynamite inside of you and just setting it off. And when it explodes, just horseshoe nails go everywhere inside of you. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? That when there's all this attitude coming at you and there's this disrespect, like, and there's this anger, there's something that, and I've watched it for years when I counsel couples, and I can feel it building. And there's the great wisdom, honestly, in saying the right thing, but in a right way that does not demasculinize him. Now, I'm careful about that word demasculinize, because if you can take away my manhood, I wasn't much of a man to begin with. So feminism did not take over America. It's not taking over masculinity. Feminism replaced masculinity. It filled a vacuum. And when men started giving themselves to pornography, and when the study was replaced by the man cave, and when you have deadbeat dads, and you have dads that are not walking in wisdom, and they care more about themselves and loving their wives, it created a vacuum, and that's why we're moving into a matriarchal scenario. Isaiah 3 details it all. We talked about that about 4 weeks ago. But the point is this, is that when I discuss something, I want to stay on issue. I want to stay in the realm of reason. And if you cannot reasonably discuss something, that means there's a wall of emotion in between you and your wife. And if you're trying to fire what I call cannonballs of logic and reason over that wall, it's never going to work. That wall is going to get higher and thicker. You need to learn to table a matter. Do what I call pin tack it. And then serve your wife, serve your spouse till that time where you discuss it. And then what happens is that wall of emotion goes away. And then you open up the true access point to that other person, which is their spirit. Because we're spirit beings. And that's why through tone of voice, when I'm discussing something, I want to try to keep my tone gentle. I want to stay on point. Because if you're not keeping someone's spirit open, you'll never reach their mind whatsoever. But if I come to you and say, why did you say that? Okay, guess what? You just closed the spirit of that person, which is their true access point, and you'll never reach their mind. Then you wonder why you're going to argue for the next 3 or 4 days or 3 or 4 hours over that. Remember, the Bible tells us that a brother offended is harder to be won than a walled city. So, in other words, notice where the focus is at. The focus is on their spirit rather than their intellect. And if you close someone's spirit, never, 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 never expect to reach their mind. And you have to serve that person to allow that wall of emotion to go down. And if I can sense if my wife is tense, one of the things I try to do is I try to back off, first of all, because I used to push it. And that wall just gets higher and thicker. Her spirit shuts even tighter. And then I've learned to serve my way through that. Now, it will be a propensity for a woman to try to control. Let's go to Genesis 3:16 for a few moments. Now, Dr. MacArthur says it very well here. Concerning Genesis 3:16 and Genesis 4:9. And I want to read the two verses here, and we need to... Oh my goodness, I just saw what time it is. Just bear with me just a few moments, if you don't mind. Genesis 3:16. He says, unto the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband. Now, if you read that, it looks like, oh, the curse is that she's going to desire her husband. It's actually not what it means. Some of you are like, yeah, that might be a curse. But anyway, Genesis 4, I'm just joking, but Genesis 4, verse 7, it says, if thou doest well, now he's talking to Cain, he said, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door, and unto thee shall be his desire. This is interesting, you read this. And what it's saying is, God is telling Cain that sin is going to control you. The same Hebrew verbiage is used here. And so when he says to the woman, thy desire shall be to thy husband, he's not saying that's the curses that you're going to want your husband. The curse is going to be that there's going to be, because, well, listen to what Dr. MacArthur says. He says it very well. He says, just as the woman and her seed will engage in a war with the serpent, i.e. Satan and his seed, because of sin and the curse, the man and the woman will face struggles in their own relationship. Sin has turned the harmonious system of God-ordained roles into distasteful struggles of self-will. Remember Paul said those that are married, he says, they will have trouble in the flesh. What that means is it's going to take work to love your spouse, which means you need to meditate in the Word and be filled with the Spirit. That's what that means. Don't try to do it without that. He says, lifelong companions, husbands and wives, will need God's help in getting along as a result. The woman's desire will be to lord it over her husband, but the husband will rule by divine design. The interpretation of the curse in Genesis 3 is based upon the identical Hebrew words in Genesis 4:7 and grammar being used, and to show that the conflict that will have that the conflict man will have with sin as it seeks to rule him. So when the Bible tells us that sin will be, when it says in Genesis 4:7, when it tells us, it says, and unto thee shall be his desire, God is telling Cain that sin will rule over you. And part of the curse, God is saying that male-female roles will be out of balance because of sin. And because of that, to try to protect yourself, to make sure he doesn't get the upper hand, you're going to try to structure with information. You're going to try to use emotional weaponry to try to control him. And God says, guess what? All those things don't work. Now, let's talk about submission for a little bit. Has to deal with authority, once again. In authority, you'll never get away from authority. The very essence of Luciferianism, honestly, is that he did not want God to be the final authority. Every person in the world is under authority. Even our current president is under the authority of the Constitution. Everybody is under authority. If you can't handle authority, you ain't handling life, and you just threw away every blessing you'll ever receive from God, because God is all about authority. Now, what if let's take logic to its perfect to its final extreme here. So my wife and I believe in headship submission. It's a beautiful phrase, beautiful verbiage, as we've talked about. It means that I love and protect her. She wants to respond to that. But what if I get into a car and I say, hey, there's a cliff over there, and as the head, I'm going to drive towards that cliff. Is my wife supposed to say, let's just take logic to its furthest extreme, is my wife supposed to say, well, I'm supposed to submit. 40 feet away, 30 feet away, I'm supposed to submit. She better stop the van, right? She better stop it. Peter, the very man that said, submit yourself to every ordinance of man, is the same man that also said in the book of Acts, it's better to obey God rather than man. But you'll find when a husband is not where he needs to be, that God says in 1 Peter 3:1, your best weapon is a spirit of respect. And you can mince that with strength, and you can mince that with obviously knowledge and wisdom, and I need more time to develop that. But I'm just trying to give you that there are these situations, especially because of the dysfunction of the American home, that you're going to have to use incredible discretion. And God talks about that. But getting back on point here, we're going to have to develop that all probably in one more lesson. A wife submits by offering her opinion in a way that allows a man to still feel like a man. I just want to say it again. There's this, just as a woman has a hurt button, when it's hurt, when she feels emotionally unsafe, something goes off inside of her. When there are words mixed with a tremendous spirit of disrespect, something goes off inside of a man. I'm not condoning his behavior like that. I'm not saying that he did right. But a woman also submits by refraining from hiding things from her husband. Hiding, and it goes along with the other point, hiding financial expenditures, events, in little circumstances can be a form of control for the wife. But the two biggest ones here I want to leave for last is the wife can submit by possessing a spirit of faith, even in his judgment calls. You know, the hardest thing about leadership is that there are calls that you have to make where there's not necessarily a right principle or a wrong principle to dictate, and either way, you can go the other way. And what I say in the article here is that it's very important, I believe, that I say that judgment calls are the highest hurdle for followers to overcome. In other words, there are some decisions that leaders must make that do not have a clear-cut answer. And if followers are not in agreement, they will often find it difficult to submit to that decision. However, I find that that wise follower will submit to judgment calls and realize that the one leading, here's the point, is accountable for that decision. It really helped me because I was very rebellious in my younger 20s. And I would find something that I believe was wrong in the hierarchy of our Bible college, and I would address it, I would speak up against it, I would resist it. I was just kind of crazy rebellious, but in my own way, I thought I was being spiritual about it. And I started realizing that there's decisions that leaders make that, you know what, they're accountable. And as long as I'm not doing something illegal, unethical, or immoral, they're accountable for that. Now, that doesn't mean that I participate in sin, but if they're making a judgment call that on something that's not illegal, unethical, or immoral, guess what? I can let them make that, and I'm not accountable for that. It's a very important part of being able to subsist in life. If not, especially as a young man in a job, you'll always be jumping from job to job. And you'll never be settled long enough to work somewhere that you need to. The wife stays away from saying, I told you so. Most of what I teach on marriage and the home is out of total failure. Total failure. Most of what I teach. But my wife has never lorded that information of my failure over me. She's never said, I told you so. And probably should have in a couple of scenarios. In my 20s, I lost thousands of dollars in stupid business deals that I never should have been a part of. Just trying to find my way. And also, by submission, I believe a wife submits to the man that she has. As Brother Brian said, comparison is the thief of joy. It's the thief of contentment. Not every man will make six-figure income, be a great extrapolator of biblical truth, be great at working outside. Not every man will be the all-American sports dad, be a Casanova, be an intellectual, or even be good with his money. Either way, the man you married is the man that God has called you to be thankful for. And being thankful for the man you have is probably the greatest mark of a submissive wife. Probably the greatest mark. Comparison is a thief of joy. And by the way, on your worst day, if you could get your worst wish of your spouse being morphed into what you think they should be, you'd probably have 1,000 more problems than you already have in your marriage. Because the woman that likes to talk about biblical things, and the woman that likes to have Bible studies, and the woman that just wishes her husband would be more verbal, She doesn't understand what comes along with the man that likes to do those things, because he's typically aggressive. He's typically dominating. He's typically everything, honestly, that you wouldn't be able to stand at all if you had to live with it on a day-to-day basis. Better be thankful for what you have, because contentment, honestly, we never would be into this mess, because Adam and Eve would probably still be in the Garden of Eden if it wasn't for discontentment. Contentment. People, and listen, if you don't live your life with an eternal view, you're going to have a hard time with contentment. Because here's what's going to go through your brain. I hear people say it all the time. My average client is between the age of 35 and 45, and you can feel it or even hear them say it. Well, if I don't jump now, this is my life for the rest of my life. Anytime someone says that, I know that they are not living with an eternal view in mind. And they're going to say, well, you only live once. No, if you're in Christ, you only live forever. This is a really, really, really short amount of time. And if God calls me for it to be my mission field in a bad relationship to use biblical weaponry to try to create the atmosphere so that person can be enhanced spiritually, then it's worth it all. It's worth it all. It's a different view, isn't it, than secular psychology? But I think it's biblical. You'll never have contentment unless you have an eternal view. Never have contentment. If we didn't have an eternal view, we could never drive on the interstate again, which I think is wildly dangerous, by the way. I think we need major laws of reformation, honestly, on the highway. Major, major laws. And we won't do it because of attorneys, and they're making bukus of money, and those guys make the laws. We need major reform on the highway. The average family used to have one car. Now they have 2.3, 2.3 cars. The average person's texting half the time. We need major reformation. So, should we... we should be scared to death. We should be scared to death to let our children go anywhere, right? But if you have an eternal view, you can deal with life.